Hello, this is Robert Noya, Editor-in-Chief of Sky and Telescope magazine. I'm on the phone with Dr. Jeffrey Hall, an astronomer at Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona. Dr. Hall authored the feature article in our July 2010 issue titled Lessons from Solar Twins. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Bob. Nice to be here.
Yeah, great. My first question is, what first made you interested in studying stars like the Sun?
Well, it sort of all spun out of the specialty or my PhD thesis in graduate school. I got involved in stellar astrophysics and ended up sort of focusing in that area of astronomy, and it's always been something I've found quite interesting. And so now I've ended up on this interesting long-term project here at Lowell.
Yeah, now, and you talk a little bit about this in the article, and we've covered this in previous articles, and that is that the Sun goes through these activity cycles that seem to last about 11 years on average. Is it understood yet what causes these cycles?
Well, the general idea of the solar cycle being created and sustained by a self-sustaining magnetic dynamo has been worked out in some detail, but there's a lot of the nitty-gritty that is still not well understood.
Right. And it's been interesting, too, and our readers are definitely aware of the fact that the Sun has been rather quiescent for a couple years now. Are there signs that its activity is starting to pick up again?
Yes, absolutely. You can see that in the most recent sunspot number reports, and we can see it as well in our spectroscopic data, the activity level starting to tick up. So whatever cycle 24 is going to turn into, it definitely has finally started.
Great. Because I know that there was at least some speculation. I personally didn't think it was that likely, but some people were talking about the possibility that this extended minimum could be a sign that the Sun is heading into a new, very prolonged minimum like the Maunder minimum. But I would think that this new activity would kind of, you know, cast doubt on that possibility.
Well, that's still pretty uncertain. There seems to be some pretty good arguments in the literature that this period of strong solar cycles that we've seen since about 1920 may be coming to an end, and that the Sun may well be making a transition into a period of either weaker cycles or a grand minimum entirely. And whether if it were going to go into a Maunder-like minimum, you know, whether it would do that by sputtering down through a couple of weak cycles or just abruptly ceasing the obvious manifestations of the cycle, we don't really know.
Yeah, now, as I understand it too, I mean, the reason why the Sun varies so much from cycle to cycle and goes through these periods of strong cycles followed by weak cycles, that's still very much unknown and is an active area of research. Is that correct?
That is correct, and it's extremely hard to predict. I mean, there's a large amount of work attempting to predict the strength of upcoming solar cycles, which has theoretical interest and it has great practical interest as well. And, for example, the early predictions for solar cycle 24 were all over the map. Some researchers were thinking it was going to be a very strong cycle, some a very weak cycle, and a lot of folks expected it would start kicking up in around 2007. And as we now know, that hasn't been the case. So, yeah, it's a very difficult and open problem.
Right. And in a little bit, we'll get into some of these ramifications for the Earth. But just stepping back and, you know, dealing directly with your article, the Sun is a G2 star that's about halfway through its life cycle of around, you know, 10 billion years. How many really good solar twins should there be in our galaxy?
Well, it appears that to have a solar twin, you really have to narrow the parameters down pretty tightly around the suns, and that, you know, constrains the sample, certainly the sample of bright stars. As I mentioned in the article, we've had this one star, 18 Scorpii, which is pretty good, and now that some astronomers have been doing surveys to slightly fainter stars, 8th, 9th magnitude, they've turned up a handful of other candidates. So already you're looking out a couple of hundred light years, and we've found just a very small number of stars that seem to be really pretty good proxies for the Sun. So to get a decent sample, we're going to have to go even farther to samples, such as the Kepler spacecraft is doing, pushed it 10th, 11th, 12th magnitude, just to get the statistics into better shape.
Right, because in your article we have a table that lists five solar twins. Is it surprising that so few have been found to date, or is it just a matter that, you know, you're looking for such like close, almost identical matches that you might have to really look out, you know, large distances to find really, really close matches to the sun?
You might well have to do that, and particularly when you start to look at one of the other things I discussed in the article, which is how not only the star's activity, but how their brightness varies. If you just look at the solar analog stars that are somewhat less similar to the sun, you start to see stars in a wide range of ages and activity levels and rotation rates, and you see variability that's substantially larger than the sun's. So to get really good suns, it appears you have to be pretty restrictive and define what you call a solar twin pretty narrowly, and of course that cuts down on the sample.
Right. And one thing, you know, we talk a little bit in the article, but not in detail, is about the various characteristics, how it might affect a star's activity cycle. So let's say you take a star that starts off its life almost identical in mass to the sun, that the sun did. If you took a star that maybe was a couple billion years younger and a couple billion years older than the sun, how might that age affect its activity cycle? Like, would it be longer, shorter cycles in the sun, stronger, weaker, or is that really not known yet?
Oh, that's actually pretty well known. In general, as a star ages, its activity decreases because the strength and the vigorousness of the activity cycle is closely tied to the star's rotation rate, mm-hmm. because it is produced by this turbulent magnetic dynamo, and the faster the star is rotating, the more vigorous that dynamo is and the more activity you see. As stars age, they spin down slowly over billions of years. So when we look at samples, stars in the original Mount Wilson sample that are very young, say like Hyades stars, which are maybe only 700 million years old, they're quite active. And then we look at the much older solar analogs, 8 or 9 billion years, and they tend to have fairly sedate or even flat activity records, very little going on at all. So, you know, that's another constraint you have to apply when you really want to look at stellar analogs of the modern-day sun. You want stars that are pretty close in age to the sun.
And how might mass and metallicity being the chemical content of the star, how would those also affect a star's activity cycle?
Well, they're... virtually any parameter you want to call out is pretty fundamental. I mean, for example, mass is going to govern pretty much everything about the star. And if you look to stars significantly more massive than the sun's, you know, F stars, early F stars, you don't tend to see a lot of solar-like cycles because as the stars become more massive, their convection zones become shallower, and there's just less grist for an activity cycle to get a hold of. And in contrast, when you go to the very low-mass stars, eventually you get stars that are fully convective or heavily spotted and have pronounced activity cycles. So, you know, that's just another set of, you know, call out whatever parameter you want. You need to find things that are quite similar to the sun.
And, you know, from these studies now of these different stars that aren't identical twins of the sun, but, you know, relatively close in many of these key parameters, what would you say are some of the real key lessons we've learned about that we can then apply to the sun and the sun's effect on Earth's climate?
Well, one of the key lessons we've learned about just recently about the brightness variations of stars is that when we do really try to narrow down the sample to the relatively bright stars as close to the sun as we can, we find that you know, their brightness variations are more or less similar to the sun's. It's been a long-standing question because in the original Mount Wilson sample, those stars tended to be somewhat more variable than the sun, but it was a much more diverse set of stars, some of them younger, more active, more massive, less massive. So one of the things we've tried to do recently is focus on the most sun-like stars that we can observe right now, which means down to 7th or 8th mm-hmm. magnitude. And we find that the sun's variations are fairly typical of those stars. What we might find when we go deeper and use an even better sample of good solar twins, well, remains to be.
Yeah, one thing I found really interesting in the article is this star Psi Serpentis is doing some really weird stuff. Do you think that might be because of its age or its mass is different from the sun?
Well, it's not really, it's not what you would call a solar twin, since it's considerably more active. What it really is a test case of a star that didn't seem to show too much of an activity variation. It goes up and down a little bit, and then it goes into this very strong, apparently four-year cycle. And the statistics are not all that great yet, but when we look at how the star's brightness varies as its activity changes, there's a hint that the character of the activity-brightness relationship may have changed as it started cycling. Now, this star isn't necessarily a very good analog for the sun, but it does kind of illustrate the different things a star can do as it varies. Does it get brighter as it gets more active? Does it get fainter as it gets more active? We're trying to constrain the envelope of things that stars can do and use that to estimate what the sun might have done over a much longer time scale than we've been able to observe.
And so that actually leads right into my next question is, you know, based on what we know about the sun's long-term behavior, but especially now adding in all this data of looking at other stars, looking at the sun's kind of the long-term future, you know, looking centuries and thousands of years into the future, what can you confidently say about what we can expect from the sun's behavior?
Well, it's been this long debate. You know, during the Maunder minimum, the question's been, what happened to the sun's brightness? It was posited that the sun might have gotten significantly dimmer than it is just at the minimum of an ordinary cycle. And so what we've been trying to do is observe all these stars like the sun to see what happens to them when they go into flat activity periods. And we're thinking now, at least on the basis of the bright stars, that it doesn't look as if the sun's overall brightness probably changed all that much during the grand minimum. You know, certainly not at the high levels that some folks have suggested. So what we think is that the current excursion of the solar brightness is probably representative of what happened at the Maunder minimum. It just sort of settled down to its current minimum level and probably sat there. That's based on statistics of a couple of stars, and it would be useful to have more good solar twins to observe and see if that holds up.
Because I guess there's, you know, two things going on then right now. You're going to continue your studies of these stars that have been monitored for several decades, so you get a longer baseline on what they're doing, and then in parallel, looking for additional and even closer matches to the sun to increase your sample size. Is that correct, that both of those efforts are very active and ongoing?
That's correct, and there's only so much that any one program can do, and so as we focus on to one sort of thing, we have to let go of another. And our trend over the past several years has been increasingly to, you know, drop the stars that are significantly warmer or cooler than the sun and really try and focus in on the very good solar analogs and the few solar twins that we know of. We're also particularly interested in stars that seem to be in low activity states or that may have made a transition into or out of a flat activity state, because those are the ones that are going to show us what the sun may do when it goes in and out of its own minima, which we know have happened numerous times in the past and certainly will happen again.
And in terms of the public interest in this, I mean, I think as from an astrophysics point of view, looking at these solar twins is interesting just from purely astrophysics, but you point out in the article that all of this could, and obviously in the past has had an influence as well on Earth's climate. So, you know, just kind of making this final connection, there's been a lot of public discussion about this whole global climate change issue, been a focus of discussion at Copenhagen, et cetera. You know, how does this all tie in then to, you know, this climate controversy that we see around us today?
Well, we certainly know that the sun influences climate. You know, the impact of the Maunder minimum on climate or various places around the world is well documented. We can see effects of the 11-year cycle even in the global temperature record. So, you know, solar impacts on climate are definitely there. And one thing I wanted to point out in the article, that the recent results from the solar radiation climate experiment, the SOARCE satellite, are really interesting because they show that the spectral distribution of the sun's variations depends on what wavelength you look at.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not been something that people have assumed when plugging solar variations into climate models. And if that holds up, it will really force us to reevaluate how we account for solar variations in the climate modeling and, closer to what I do, how we interpret stellar variations. Because mm-hmm. when we observe stellar brightness changes, we do that in a very specific part of the spectrum. And we need to rethink that, possibly, in light of these new results from SOARCE.
And, you know, assuming we're coming up on a fairly weak cycle 24, and if we have, let's say, several weak cycles after that, could one argue that that might actually be a good thing if doing things to the planet to make the Earth get warmer and the sun kind of maybe ramping down a little bit, could this kind of be good timing for humanity?
Well, I don't know, because it all depends on how solar variations manifest themselves in climate effects. And, you know, climate change is not quite as simple as people are warming the planet and an inactive sun cools the planet because of the spectral and spatial complexity of the phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
If the sun were to go into an extended minimum, there might be, and I'm speculating a little bit here, of course, but there might be minimal effects in some parts of the world and perhaps major effects on temperature and precipitation elsewhere, just as the Maunder minimum was not a uniform global event. It appears to have been spatially complicated. So there's a lot of aspects to all this that we don't understand very well yet.
Right, which is why it's a good thing we have people like you doing this kind of research to try to give us some ability to anticipate what to expect in the future.
Well, it's certainly an interesting area to be in, both astrophysically and practically. And you know, I've found it very rewarding to kind of watch these patterns that take years or decades to happen, to watch them emerge in the data. It's always rather exciting to go to a new observing season and see what different targets on our list are doing this year, and being rather sure that they'll surprise us in one way or another.
That answers the questions I had. Was there anything else, Jeff, that you'd like to add that I did not ask you about?
No, I think that covers it pretty thoroughly.
Great. I want to thank you for your time today, and I really appreciate your time talking to us.
Absolutely, and I enjoyed writing the article.